We are now on chapter 17 of the book of Genesis. But before we go there, I did a little research. And I want to go over with you, let's see, where is the... All right, I may have to wait on this till next time because I'm missing a crucial piece of this. One second. Oh, it must be 9:6. It just must be miswritten. Okay, here it is. If you remember, when we were studying earlier, the division of Abraham and Lot, we talked about when they divide up their properties, and Abraham is going to go one way and Lot's going to go the other, because they're just, you know, there isn't enough, at least in Lot's reckoning, for both of them. And now I'm back in chapter 13. No, that's not where it is. I'm sorry. Maybe someone's calling to bail me out. All right, I'll check back on it, and I'll get back to you next time. I was looking for, unless someone remembers, where the Shalshelet was we were talking about before. Do you remember the note that has the three trills? Because I did more research on the Shalshelet, but now I don't remember where the original occurrence was, and I don't think I have that here. I think the first time we find it is in Sodom, but I don't remember why we started to talk about it. When we get to it in Sodom, I'll talk about it more. But we had, I remember, a discussion about that note. But I'll return to it, actually, in two chapters. Okay. So, with that worthless opening, let's go to chapter 17. We talked about the first sentence last time, actually the first couple of sentences, and the meaning of the name El Shaddai. El Shaddai is usually associated with power. That's God's name for power. Also, Dai, like Dayenu, means enough. And so you get two sides of interpretation. One is, this is the name where God says, I'm only going to create so much. I'm going to say Dai to myself. I'm going to be self-limiting. And the rest of the world is up to human beings to create. And not exactly the flip side, but it's a complementary interpretation from Rabbi Hirsch that this is the God who teaches human beings how to set limits. And according to Hirsch, all of Judaism is in fact about setting limits. That's what Judaism is. It is an education to human beings about how to set limits. So we talked about that last time. And then God says to him, walk in my ways and be blameless, right? Tamim, or be pure, and we'll say a little bit about that in a moment, and then goes on to establish the covenant. Now, first of all, notice that El Shaddai, which is a name, by the way, that I read in Yeshayahu Leibovitz's book on the Torah, is used a lot in the book of Job. And he asks, what's the similarity here between Abraham and Job? Which is a good question. Is Job Jewish?
He complains a lot.
Right. That's what we call a necessary but not sufficient indication that somebody is Jewish. So according to the tradition, no, Job is not Jewish. Although some claim him for Judaism, but predominantly there's no indication that he's Jewish. I mean, his friends mourn with him for 7 days, but that's not That's not obviously a tradition that is necessarily unique, even though we derive Shiva from that and related traditions. However, since there doesn't seem to be in Job's world any kind of ritual behavior, what Leibovitz says is that Abraham and Job both stand before God without mitzvot. Right? Abraham doesn't have the Torah yet. Job isn't Jewish. And interestingly enough, without mitzvot, what they feel from God primarily is raw power. What they don't feel is the language of relationship. Leibovitz doesn't put that in. That's my twist on it. Because there is something about ritual that is taming of that kind of raw power, right? You feel, just think of it. You feel a thunderstorm. You feel frightened of it. So you say something or you do something, and ritual somehow calms the natural world. That's part of what rituals are about. Kid's room is scary at night, and you walk around with a spray bottle and say, this is the anti-monster spray. The child knows it's not really an anti-monster spray, right? They're old enough to understand that, and you know it, but there is in the ritual of doing it something that tames the natural forces. And I think that in a scary world, one of the things that ritual does, and here I'll say what mitzvot do, is look at what we just did. Ariel Sharon had a cerebral hemorrhage. Now, people don't recover from cerebral hemorrhages. They just don't. I still said a bracha. It's a way of managing your own powerlessness in the face of forces that are greater than you. So Avraham encounters God as El Shaddai because at this point Avraham does not have mitzvot. Job encounters God as El Shaddai because Job too doesn't have what we might think of as the cloak of tradition to enable him to handle what he is too great for him to handle. When people are sick, there is a very powerful impulse to pray, to have prayers said on your behalf. And it's not only an impulse because you think, it might work, but it's also an impulse because you have to do something. You can't just sit there. So that may also be part of what El Shaddai is about. Now also remember that Abraham is an old man at this time, and when God says, I'm going to establish my covenant between me and you, this is a way of saying, as old as you are, you're at the beginning, right? This is not a final act. Okay, so now, I want to compare, what does this remind you of? When else does God, you may not remember where, but remember that previously God talks to Abraham and says to him, here are the stars of the sky, I'll make you just as numerous, back in chapter 15. And this is a repetition, and here in the commentary that I have in front of me, there's a nice comparison between the two. So you can take a look at chapter 15 and chapter 17. You can flip back and forth, and I'll read you what Nachum Sarna, who passed away this past year, a Bible scholar, writes about the comparison between the two. He says, in the earlier passage, that is in chapter 15, Abraham is passive. God just says, don't worry, I'm going to make you a great nation. Abraham doesn't have to do anything. Now Abraham has to do something. He becomes an active partner, right? This is a brit now, this is a covenant, and covenant has two partners. It can't just be Abraham sits there and God showers him with blessings. Well, you know what Abraham's part is going to be, yes? He's right, circumcision. That's what we're going to get to in just a moment. So that's the first thing. In both cases, it begins with the introductory formula, I am. Look in 15:7. Vayomer elav ani Adonai. God says, I am God. And here too, right? Vayhi Avram ben Tishim Shana. Vayomer elav ani El Shaddai. Two different names, but in both cases, God begins by identifying God's self. Right? This is who I am. both promise a son, but for the first time here, Sarah is designated, the matriarch, as the future mother. Look at 17:16, for example. I will bless her, I will give you a son by her. This refers to Sarai, whose name is about to be changed, it was changed in 17:15. Now, why is it that this second promise has to include, I'm going to give you a son by Sarah? Because we've just gone through the Ishmael. I just want to refresh our memories. We've just gone through the abortive Ishmael project, right, where Abraham got a son, but it was not the right son. So he ends up getting kicked out of the house and then brought back to the house. But God this time is more specific, right? You learn that again. You learn that as a parent. First instruction was not specific enough. All you said was clean your room. You didn't say, you know, remove the pile of papers from your desk. Second time you come back and say, cleaning your room means removing the piles of paper from your desk. God comes back and says, giving you a son who will carry on the tradition means giving you a son with Sarah. Perhaps I wasn't clear the first time since you had that little Ishmael incident. But it really, I mean, it is interesting to see that it changes. The nature of God's promise changes. And here is where, in a completely untraditional way, all right? In an untraditional way, you can read the Bible with an eye towards how God's self-presentation changes as God interacts more and more with human beings. Because we don't normally think of God as a learning God, but the Bible does present God that way. God clearly changes and gets to know people better and gets to know certain individuals better, even though that's not the sense of God that we normally are taught. Okay. Both chapters promise many offspring, right, like the stars of the heaven, and also the land of Israel, but only here. Look at the land of Israel. Well, you compare and tell me what the difference is. 15:18. It says, and this is a good morning to read this. It says, on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your offspring I assign the land from the river of Egypt to the great river, Euphrates, the Canaanites, the Kenizzites, the Cadmonites, and then he goes on, the Hittites, and so on and so forth. Okay? That's it. Now, compare that to 17:8. What's the difference? 17:8. I assign the land you sojourn in to you and to your offspring to come. All the land of Canaan is an everlasting holding. I will be their God. All of a sudden, the land is assigned forever. It's not a temporary assignment anymore. Once Isaac is going to be Abraham's heir, it's going to be theirs forever. Okay? And finally, both record Abraham's reaction. Right? Abraham in chapter 15 says, first, since I don't have any offspring, how do I know I'm going to inherit it? And then here in 17:17, you can look at Abraham's reaction. He throws himself on the face and laughs. As he said to himself, can a child be born to a man 100 years old, or can Sarah bear a child at 90? Both times, Abraham is skeptical, which we don't normally think of in terms of Abraham. But the first time God promises him, he says, look, I don't have a son. Then God gives him a son that doesn't prove to be the son who is going to carry on the tradition. God comes again and says, I'm going to give it to you forever. And God laughs, and Abraham laughs and says, you know, I'm 90 years old. There's really a limit even to what God can do, which is really the implication here, that Abraham doesn't believe that God can give him a son at that age. Okay? And I say this with the caveat that I have mentioned before, that Saul Bellow, who passed away just a few months ago, had a son at age 82 or 83. So, I mean, apparently God can work wonders for old Jewish men. Yes.
I find this troubling because this week's parsha has Jacob convinced that the Pharaoh means well, and he picks up baggage, and all of Judaism, all of Israel, taking their all their belongings with them, go to Egypt, right, turning their back on Canaan.
Right. Surely that is a great question to ask when we get to that part of the Torah. But I don't want to get started, because if we get started on that, well, and we'll get to the Joseph story in, like, you know, 2009. So don't. So just hold that question. Just hold that thought. It is true that the going down to Egypt. I'll take that in one second. But the going down to Egypt is problematic in the sense that it's prejudged. It's predicted that you're going to go down to Egypt. It's obviously bad to go down to Egypt, and it happens anyway, and it raises all those questions. However, the theme of emerging from slavery to become a nation is, I think, actually a very powerful and meaningful theme, in the same way that we want to read the stories of lives of people who've gone through hardship. Right? If you read the story of somebody who went from success to success to success and never suffered, there's very little to extract from it.
But you just stated a rather interesting insight, that God changes as he
yes.
gets to know us more. So perhaps here we see a sign of that change as his creation, the interplay now begins to unfold a different story.
Right.
So what was a permanent gift and promise may not be so, because as you point out, a covenant's a two-way street.
Yes, there's a lot of discussion later on in what we might call covenantal theology about whether the covenant of Israel can ever be abrogated. I mean, the predominant belief in the Jewish tradition is that it's a, you know, as it says here, achuzat olam, it's a permanent possession. It can never be abrogated. It can be Jews. I mean, look, even in the Bible, if the golden calf doesn't abrogate the covenant, and the sin of the spies doesn't abrogate the covenant, and all the later sins, especially of the kings of Israel, don't abrogate the covenant. So it is beyond our poor power to add or detract. Yeah. Yes, we are now in chapter 17, but we are only on verse 2. I did, but yeah. There's a lot of, right, there, yeah, if it's only about the end and it doesn't, so let's save it. And I'll point out in two, a very interesting thing, which is, it says, v'etna briti, and I give my brit, okay, which is not usually the phrase that's used, but you give a brit if it already exists. So, one, I'm trying to remember where Hirsch said this. It might be that God already has a covenant with people, but is now transferring it to Abraham. Because ve'etna brit means I give the brit. And we know that God has a covenant with humanity because God strikes a covenant with Noah. So there is this nice idea that there's, what's going on is a transfer of loyalty. God saying, okay, I'm now assigning my loyalty to you. You're the one who I want to do this. Not anybody else. Anyway, all right. Abraham falls on his face. Now let's go to verse 3. And we know, because he's about to be circumcised and he's now promised a child, when God says, stand before me and be pure, it might be that God is saying, unlike when you had Ishmael. Because if God is saying, all right, I want you to be pure now and to bring Isaac into the world, that you can hear from that you weren't pure when Ishmael was born, that it didn't work out as a result, possibly not only of that it wasn't Sarah, but also that you weren't what you needed to be, and now is the time to have the right child. Okay, and God says to him, as for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be the multitude of nations, and you shall no longer be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I will make you a father of a multitude of nations. What letter does God add to make Abram Abraham? What is he? God's name. Okay? Just so you should know what's involved here, right? It is the addition of God's name and essence to Abraham that makes him Abraham, and the same thing with Sarai and Sarah, right? And tradition has it, by the way, that Sarai's Yud went to Hoshea to become Yehoshua. But that's a nice little midrash about how Joshua gets his name. Okay, so there is this new covenant, God says, I'll make you exceedingly fertile and make nations of you, and kings shall come forth. I will maintain my covenant between me and you and your offspring to come as an everlasting covenant throughout the ages. And that suggests that the covenant never gets changed, right? God doesn't make this a conditional covenant, even though covenants you would think would be conditional. And there are times when God refers to it as conditional later on in the Bible. If you follow my laws and if you do this, but the initial covenant with Abraham, which here is, well, I'll say that in a second, is unconditional. And remember earlier, how is it solemnified? How is it, you know, what makes the covenant? You know, in a ketubah signing, you have to agree to this covenant. There has to be some sign that you agree. How does God show that God agrees to the covenant in chapter 15? Do you remember? Right, burns the animals, a covenant between the pieces. The fire comes and divides them up. In other words, there is a physical, I don't know how to say it, because in Abraham's case, it's going to be an operation, but there is a physical cut to the animal body that creates the covenant between the pieces, and Abraham's going to have the same thing. Okay.
Not wanting to appear a feminist, where does this leave women in terms of the covenant? So, with God?
Great question. The question is, where does this leave women in terms of the covenant with God? I'll give you two different answers, and I'll give you three. You'll do with them what you want. The first is, I'm saying this because they come from different strands of Jewish interpretation, and I don't want to prejudice which one.
Okay.
One is that Sarah and Abraham are essentially one entity. And Sarah, by the fact that her name gets changed, is clearly implicated in this arrangement, right? The two of them together. Just as when God says to Abraham, Lech Lecha, which is singular, Abraham and Sarah both go. Because this is, even though God's speaking to Abraham, it's about both of them. When he says, you'll have a child, it clearly means Sarah, because when it's with someone else, it doesn't work. The second answer, which is an answer to the question of brit, of covenant today, and I'll talk about brit milah in just a minute, is that women are on a higher spiritual level and don't need brit. And that is you'll find that answer very commonly disseminated in the traditional community.
On what is that base that women are on a higher spiritual level?
On the observation of anybody who knows men and women.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't think that it's purely casual or prejudicial. I mean, look, if you have kids and you have a boy and you have a girl of the same age, what are the chances that the boy will be more mature? Right, what are the chances that the boy will care more about serious things? What are the chances, and also one last point, when they are given equal opportunities, you almost always find that the connection to religious life, the training of children in the home, is almost always the mother, and in fact, they've done a zillion studies, as you know, on intermarriages, and the mother has a much, much, much greater influence on boys and girls in terms of her religious outlook than the father does. Not always decisive, obviously, but you're much more likely to get a Jewish kid if you have a Jewish mother than if you have a non-Jewish mother and a Jewish father. Yeah. Yes, there are. Right. There are, yeah, there are. The Kabbalah does an awful lot with God's feminine presence with the Shekhinah and with the idea of Kabbalistic union, that God is male and female and there's union. But this idea that also, I mean, there are other questions about where women fit in Jewish law that are beyond our scope at the moment, unless we want to devote a separate class to that. But that's the second answer. The second answer, which is very widespread in traditional communities, is that women are on a higher spiritual level and don't need brit. And the third answer is the answer that your question implies, which is, it was a patriarchal society. It was men who were counted, and you needed to create a ceremony for men because, after all, in the Bible, unlike later Jewish tradition, it's the man who seems to be to determine the Jewish clan, right? You know, it's, I mean, when you go out and conquer, it's women who marry Israelite men who raise Jewish children. That changes with around the time of Ezra and Nehemiah for other reasons, but those are the three possibilities. Now, I'm not going to go through it all now, but I just did for the last Lunch and Learn, not this past Tuesday, but last month, I did a review of a book called Marked in Your Flesh, which is by Leonard Glick and is the most thorough history of circumcision that has yet been written in English. And he's an anthropologist and also a doctor, and he comes out at the end against Brit Milah, against circumcision. And it was so interesting because, among other things, he talks about how there really isn't any medical benefit, despite all the studies. He quotes other studies, and he goes through a long and very particular litany of the various studies that have been done. And I then did a little bit of other research in other books, and I questioned whether it's going to be published, the review is going to be published in BeliefNet in a couple of weeks, but I questioned whether he was honest in his recounting or whether he downplayed things. Anyway, the morning I was supposed to give the review, in the Los Angeles Times, a couple of epidemiologists came out and said that boys should be circumcised because it's a clear protection against HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. And I thought, there is a God, because it was just in time to write the review and to get, it was right, I mean, I open up the LA Times, and there on the very first page, on the left-hand column, is these two epidemiologists who were not Jewish, at least not by their names, I don't think they were Jewish, one from UCLA and one from Cleveland or Chicago, I don't remember. And they said that, you know, that the resistance of some parents to do it is because they don't want to say, well, you know, why should I think that in 20 years this is going to happen to my child, that he'll engage in risky behavior or whatever. And they said, all we can say is there are protections that you can use for every incident, or there's a protection that you can give your child for his whole life. So anyway, for what it's worth, it's interesting because, you know, the whole question of the extent to which ritual affects health is an ongoing question. People used to believe that kashrut was for health reasons, but I think that's pretty much discredited these days. But Brit Milah is obviously still an open question. So, sure, absolutely. That's right, that'll teach you to ask a question. Okay. I assign the land to you, sojourn into you and your offspring to come, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting holding. And then it says, Vahayiti lahem le'elohim. I will be their God. Okay? Now, again, there are a couple ways of reading this. When it says, I will be their God, it's a very local, tribalized, I'll be Israel's God sort of statement. Right? Does that mean that God only expects to be Israel's God? Or does that mean that God only expects Israel to recognize God? Or does it mean, I'm just going to start off with this group, but eventually we'll spread to the world? It's very interesting that if you read the Torah with a slightly different eye, right, with the eye of a modern scholar, then you see a development of the idea that God is really the God of the whole world. It doesn't necessarily start that way. Although, it depends when different parts were written. Because if it was written from chapter 1 and on, then God is clearly the God of the whole world, because chapter 1 starts with creation of the world. Right. But if you only had this story, or this story was older than the creation of the world story, you think, well, God is just this local God, just Abraham's God and Israel's God, and, you know, the Phoenicians have their God, and the Canaanites have their God, and we have our God. And this is just a contract with the Israelite people, with Abraham and the Israelite people, and other people may later on be able to get into the contract, but that's only if they give up their local gods, which is the way the ancient world usually worked. You had your God, I had my God, we have a war. If you win, I take your God, because your God is stronger. Okay, I may keep my God as a minor God, which is, you may know, what many Israelites did. They still dig up statues of Baal all over Israel because the Israelites who had gotten used to idol worship, even though they accepted God as God, you know, it doesn't mean you have to throw Baal out with the bathwater. You still want to keep a little, sorry about that. You still want to keep a little, I wasn't planned, if that's any comfort to you. You still want to keep a little security, no reason to offend a God by completely disregarding them, right? In the same way that people today will say, of course I'm not superstitious. I'm not going to walk under the ladder because why should you tempt fate, right? It just doesn't make sense, so I won't walk under it. But of course I don't really believe it. But the feeling inside people to do something, it's that ritual feeling is very strong. And as Thomas de Quincey said, not to be a little superstitious is to lack generosity of mind. So, what can I tell you? Of course, his most famous book was called Confessions of an Opium Eater, but nonetheless.
He was smoking dope.
Yeah, he was at the time. All right. Okay, great. So we are on chapter 9. Any comments or questions up to now on
chapter
anything?
Nine?
I mean, verse 9.
We just moved right along, don't we?
Yeah, we moved through that pretty quickly. That was 8 verses there. In Sarna's commentary here, he says, the inauguration of a new era or a new state policy would frequently be marked by the assumption of a new name on the part of the king. A classic example is Amenhotep number 4 of Egypt, who changed his name to Akhenaten, testifying to the revolutionary theology he imposed on his people. Remember, Akhenaten was the one who worshipped the sun. He was the first monotheist that we know of outside of Israel. Of course, his monotheism was a worship of the sun, but it was worship only of the sun, right? It was like monotheistic idolatry, basically. The Bible records several name changes of personalities. Anyway, after this, by the way, unlike Jacob, you know, Abraham is always called Abraham. Never goes back to Abram. Sarai never goes back to Sarai. Their change is permanent, and we can talk when we get to Jacob about why it is that Jacob's change is not permanent, right? Why sometimes Jacob and sometimes Israel. But Abraham's is permanent. And verse 9. God further said to Abraham, as for you, you and your offspring to come throughout the ages shall keep my covenant. Et briti tishmor. Now, here is a very powerful theological question, which is the extent to which, and this is, by the way, that book, Marked in My Flesh About Circumcision, really turned on this question. How much are you allowed to make a decision for your children? I mean, after all, a brit milah is voluntary surgery, and the child involved is not volunteering, right? That was his essential argument. How can you have discretionary surgery for your child before they are old enough to make a choice? Now, Jewish parents do it, and we can discuss why, but here, Abraham obligates all his descendants forever to keep a covenant that they didn't agree to. Which is why you get the Midrash that all of Israel was at Sinai. That idea that all of Israel is at Sinai, you know, it's a very nice idea for sermons. But the reason it arose was because of this problem. When people would say, I didn't agree to this, the answer was, yes, you did. Because everyone was at Sinai. And you may not remember, but you were there, right? So you in fact did agree. Now, that of course poses problems because that means that, and this is true according to Jewish law, even if you abandon Judaism, you're still obligated. It doesn't matter. You can convert all you want. According to Jewish law, you still have to keep Shabbos. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I would put it differently. It's the beginning of Jewish obligation, and any obligation entails guilt if you don't fulfill it and you feel that it's legitimate, right? Guilt is, healthy guilt arises from an obligation that you think you should fulfill and you don't. So the question here is this a legitimate obligation? Yeah. I mean, if you think you should do something and you don't do it and you feel guilty, that's... But here, the problem, of course, is that the obligation is not assumed. It's imposed. And so the question is, at what point do you assume it? Now, you may know, for example, when someone converts to Judaism, if they are converted as a child, then when they reach the age of 12 for a girl, 13 for a boy, they are permitted to renounce their conversion because they didn't choose it, and they have to choose it. But that presumes, of course, that we all did choose it if we were born Jewish. So that's what this is about. This is about the obligation that you're born into. Yeah.
Well, you just said that if someone converts to another religion from Judaism, they must still keep...
According to Jewish law, Judaism doesn't recognize the legitimacy of that conversion. Not according to law. Practically, Jews do. But according to law, they don't.
So if someone renounces Judaism in order
you
to
can't.
Become Catholic...
You can't renounce Judaism according to Judaism.
You cannot.
Nope. Once you're born Jewish, you're Jewish. Doesn't matter what you say. The Archbishop of Rome should be keeping kosher. Because he was born Jewish.
He was?
Yes, he speaks a perfect Yiddish, believe it or not. He was born Jewish. He was hidden in a monastery in World War II, trained as a Catholic, but originally was raised as a Jew, and became a Catholic when he left the monastery after the war, and grew up in the church, and is very, by the way, very sympathetic to Jewish causes and Jewish people. Speaks, as I said, a perfect Yiddish, but is Catholic. I mean, he's the Archbishop of Rome. He's a Catholic, you know? Yes?
That your phrase just frightened me because...
Okay, he's mostly Catholic.
No. Oh. If we are always Jewish because we're Jewish, that gives credence to the racialists. And wasn't that the problem that Buber found himself in early?
Well, no,
it's... away a little bit. He said, we can't have this transmitted... I'm not saying it correctly, but I think you're
right. Well, the only reason it doesn't give credence to the racialists is because you can choose it. You can't choose to be African American. You can't choose to be Chinese, but you can choose to be Jewish. And also, there are black Jews, there are yellow Jews, there are white Jews. There's clearly no racial component. What there is a metaphysical inheritance, according to the Jewish tradition. And by the way, this was used in particular, interestingly enough, it's so interesting how things come about. And I'll give you an indication from the synagogue that we were just talking about the other day, and an indication from Jewish history. This principle, Yisrael, afal pi shechata Yisrael, who, an Israelite, even if he sins, remains an Israelite, and here sins means converts, became an important principle at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. Many, many, many Jews converted to Christianity. Some of them out of conviction, don't kid yourself, many of them out of duress. Those Jews who converted out of duress, once they found their way back into a Jewish community, the Jewish community didn't want to make them go through a conversion, humiliate them, and maybe drive them away. So what they said was, doesn't matter that you converted. A Jew is a Jew is a Jew. You're a Jew. You can come in. All you have to do is rejoin the community, and you can have... Now, you can say this person can't get an aliyah, for example, right? Which is a Jew who is not circumcised. This is what often happens, right? They're still Jewish, right? A boy doesn't become not Jewish if you don't circumcise him. But in some communities, they won't give the person an aliyah. They won't give them any honors. They ask them to be circumcised before they become full members of the community. So even though the principle at first seems negative, the truth is it was enforced largely to bring people back in. But, you know, laws have different valences at different times in history. So, yeah.
So, to get a little picky, isn't there places where... you can be severed. Your soul can be severed.
Your soul can be severed. You can have karet. Yes, you're cut off from your people. But you're still a Jew. You're just cut off from the community of Israel. Yes, if, for example, you don't... Well, that what exactly that means, it can mean something both in this world and can mean something in the next. In this world, the punishment of cherem, which is of being an exile, like Spinoza is the most famous example in Jewish history, means that nobody in the community can go near you, can have dealings with you, can talk to you, but you're still a Jew. If you weren't a Jew, people wouldn't be so upset. The whole point is you don't put a Christian in cherem. You only put a Jew in cherem, right? In the same way that, when you're not talking to your kid, it's because he's your kid. If it wasn't your kid, you talk to him, right? No big deal. You don't care if the next door neighbor breaks your windows, but it's your kid. So, I mean, it sounds strange, but that's true. That's the way, it is an act of intimacy to cut somebody off. You know, it really is. People that aren't close to you, you know, if I read about a criminal in the paper, I don't say, I'm never speaking to him again, you know? There are certain mitzvot that you can't perform because they require a community. But that doesn't mean that you're not a Jew. You are still a Jew. And by the way, one of the things that you get karet for is not keeping, one of the big ones is not keeping Pesach. So, a lot of this is also sociological because cherem is almost never practiced these days except in now ultra-Orthodox communities in Israel where they're always putting each other in cherem, so much so that it almost doesn't matter anymore. The last cherem in America that got any kind of press was Mordechai Kaplan. When Mordechai Kaplan came out with his, I don't remember if it was his Haggadah, I think it was his Sidur, and he made all these, Mordechai Kaplan was a teacher at the Jewish Theological Seminary and the founder of Reconstructionism. And when he came out with his Sidur, he made all sorts of changes. In particular, he didn't like the concept of the chosen people. So he took that out of the prayers. And they burned his books, and they put him in cherem. Now, what often happens in the modern world is the people who put you in cherem are the people who won't talk to you anyway, right? So it's not like one day all these ultra-Orthodox rabbis were having coffee with Kaplan, and the next day he was alone in the coffee, nobody showed up. But what was interesting and what made this actually a drama that was of some interest to American Jewish history is the very traditional rabbis in the seminary, because there were some much more traditional rabbis than Kaplan, Saul Lieberman, Louis Ginsberg, who were themselves very traditional, and didn't approve of what Kaplan taught or what Kaplan did at all, they had to now react to the fact that people were putting him in cherem. So they didn't approve of the cherem and they didn't approve of him. It was very, it was a very interesting time to, what's that?
Was Sholem Ash put in cherem?
I would not be surprised. I would bet that he was. Sholem Ash was a very interesting character. He was a writer who wrote very popular books that Jews loved about Jewish history, and then gradually came to write more and more sympathetic books about Jesus. In particular, a book called The Man from Nazareth, I think was the...
Nazarene.
What's that?
The Nazarene.
The Nazarene. And that became, and so the Jewish community felt, to put it mildly, very uneasy about Sholem Ash. I don't think Steinberg was ever put in cherem. I think because Steinberg was of a generation already after Kaplan that, it was Mordechai Kaplan and Jacob Cohn, who was the sort of founding rabbi of Sinai Temple, although he wasn't literally the founding rabbi, but the archetypal, let me put it this way, he's the only rabbi whose picture is up in this place. I'll leave that aside for the moment. It was Jacob Cohn and Mordechai Kaplan who convinced Milton Steinberg to go to rabbinical school. It was the two of them. Milton Steinberg, who was probably, he died at a tragically young age in his early 40s, but he was probably was or would have been the greatest American rabbi. He was the one who wrote As a Driven Leaf, and he was the rabbi of Park Avenue Synagogue. Jacob Cohn was his teacher. Jacob Cohn was the one who told him he should go to rabbinical school. So, all right, so where are we? We're with all that, I don't remember, that's the question of cherem and karet. I would say that every community has to have a means of policing itself. They just do. And every community has standards, and if you fall below those standards, you're out. And every community standards seem unreasonable to people outside that community who don't share them, right? That's part of what it means, you know. In the same way, and this is a problem that every institution, every people, every school has. Just ask the people who run Sinai Akiba when a child isn't admitted. And you can't say we have standards, because as soon as you say we have standards, that means our standards exclude you. And we live in a society in which exclusion is a very bad word. So most institutions have a very hard time enunciating standards that exclude people, but all of them, in one way or another, have to do it, right? It's a very hard question for a synagogue, what you do with members who are married to non-Jewish spouses. Are the non-Jewish spouses members? Can they come up on the bima? Can they get an aliyah? Can they be buried in a Jewish cemetery? All these questions are real questions in a pluralistic world. And all of them go back to the exact same question as karet and cherem, which is, when is somebody in, when is somebody out, and what's a permissible exclusion and what's a forbidden one? Yeah. No, you don't have to. They're still a Jew. It doesn't mean you have to honor them. Right, you wouldn't honor them.
Okay, so what other consequences are there?
The only consequence that I'm aware of is that the Jewish tradition still obligates them to obey Jewish law. That's the only practical consequence. That's why, but realize there's an organic definition and there's a legal definition. The organic definition is, in fact, they're no longer part of the Jewish community. They're not part of the Jewish community. That's why when you say, for example, somebody is a Jew for Jesus, the answer is they're not, right? Because from the time that Paul first had his revelation, a Jew for Jesus was called a Christian. That's exactly what a Jew for Jesus is, right? All the early Christians were Jews. They decided Jesus was the Messiah. They called themselves Christians, which is why a Jew for Jesus is really a marketing ploy. It's a way of trying to persuade Jews they can still be Jewish but accept Jesus. But in fact, for 2,000 years, that's exactly how you become a Christian, is by accepting Jesus. That's the only definition. But if you say to me, is a Jew for Jesus halachically a Jew? The answer is yes. Halachically, they are a Jew, but in every practical sense, they've become a Christian, in the same way that you don't get, Christians for Muhammad. A Christian for Muhammad becomes a Muslim. So a Jew for Jesus is a Christian. And that's why a Jew for Jesus would never honor them. We would never give them a place on the bima and so on. And anyway.
What about their kids?
What about?
Would they're considered Jews?
You know, this is a really interesting. I faced this exact question, as a matter of fact. Many years ago, someone asked me if I could. It turned out I couldn't do their wedding, but someone asked me to do their wedding, whose mother had converted to Christianity before she was born, before the daughter was born, obviously. Before the daughter was born, the mother converted to marry her father, who was not Jewish. So she has a Jewish mother who converted to Christianity and a non-Jewish father, and she asked me to do her wedding to a Jew. And she's a good friend. And I consulted with a couple of rabbis, and the answer that I got, which I thought was the best answer, was that I should ask her to go to mikveh. She doesn't have to go through all the conversion rituals, she doesn't have to get a conversion certificate, but she ought to go to mikveh as an affirmation of her assertion of her Jewish identity, because without that, you really shouldn't marry her as a Jew. And I thought but it's a very gray area of Jewish law. And so I called her and I said, if you can go to mikveh, I can marry you, but otherwise, I can't do it. Yeah. Right. Well, to sign as a witness, there are higher standards. To sign as a witness on the ketubah, since you're going to be a witness in court, you have to be, according to Jewish tradition, you're supposed to find somebody who is a practicing Jew, who is as traditional as possible and so on. They have to sign the ketubah in Hebrew. They can't sign it in English. So these days, obviously, witnesses come in many shapes and sizes, but that's the same reason why witnesses can't be related to the bride or groom. You can't be related to the bride or groom because then your testimony isn't considered unbiased in court. So I would not allow somebody to sign who had converted to Christianity, but I would still, or married a Christian ideally, but I would still consider that person obligated according to Jewish law to keep kosher and keep Shabbos, and to contribute to the centennial campaign. the three pillars of Jewish observance. Yes, last question. Well, the mom converted, but the mother was born Jewish, so the mother, according to Jewish law, was Jewish, and the daughter considered herself Jewish. So if she had not considered herself Jewish, I would have said, you should study, you should, you know, go through this. But she thought of herself as Jewish, and she was halachically Jewish, right? According to Jewish law, she was Jewish because her mother was Jewish, and you can't renounce that. According to Jewish law, she is, because you can't, you know, look at what it says, you know. The offspring throughout the ages shall keep my covenant. And that's an obligation. And even if you don't want it, it's still yours. So her mother could depends. Whether she could be buried in a Jewish cemetery is an open question, but I think most rabbis would probably bury her in a Jewish cemetery because she's still considered a Jew. Yeah. In part, but not only that, there's a long history to it. So,
is there any particular group of people who are the carriers of halacha? Is it what is now considered Orthodox Judaism?
There's no one group of people. Halacha is a system of study and tradition throughout the ages, mostly by poskim, who are called legal deciders, basically. And there's a large body of Jewish law contained in many, many, many books, and it's an ongoing process. No, there isn't. There's a lot of variation about it, and there are books written about the various attitudes towards converts and towards conversion, both to Christianity and away from Christianity. But the prevailing halachic principle is that there's a long article by Jacob Katz, I don't know if it's in English, about the variations of exactly that principle. An Israelite, even though he sins, remains an Israelite. I have it in Hebrew, but I don't know if it exists in English.
So, the question I have is whether people outside of Orthodox
They have influence on non-Orthodox halacha, but not on Orthodox halacha. You won't be able to influence what somebody learns at Yeshiva University, but you may be able to influence what somebody learns at the Jewish Theological Seminary of the UJ. Okay, thank you. And there are, by the way, Reform and Conservative responsa and collections of them.